want to impact the other speakers afterwards. So now is probably a good time to begin. My name is Johnny Lin, and I'm an associate professor of physics at North Park University, and I will be your moderator for today, and I'm also the first speaker. So I'm Johnny Lin, and I'm an assistant associate professor of physics. My area of expertise and training is climate dynamics, and along the way, I've kind of gotten a little interested in science, ethics, policy, theology, interactions, and so this paper is dealing with that, and let's just get started. Okay. So the title of this paper is on eschewing a policy prescriptive role for science in environmental controversies. And I guess in the liberal arts or in the humanities, people actually read their papers. And so this is also going to be my first non-extemporaneous talk. So I'll just do the humanities thing. Okay. Because science is the study of nature, many often assume that science has a special authority regarding environmental problems. Thus, for many, debates over environmental problems are debates over the science of the problem. What does science say the problem is, and how should we fix the problem? While those who ascribe such authority to science may greatly value theology and ethics, the content or substance of stewardship is seen as justified by the science. Theology tells us why we need to care for creation. Ethics gives us standards by which we can evaluate how a healthier environment flows from and contributes to the moral life. And science tells us what a healthier environment is and the actions to make it healthy. In this present work, I will argue that for all of its descriptive power, science is not, in general, quote, policy prescriptive, unquote, and does not directly prescribe the content of environmental stewardship. Thus, debates over what constitutes an environmental problem and what practices are needed to fix the problems cannot be settled solely by an appeal to science. Science needs the help of ethics to define policy. First, we'll consider philosophical arguments about whether science determines policy goals and find that science alone cannot, in general, do so. Second, we consider how policy goals are translated into policy choice and find that here, too, that science and ethics together determine which policies to implement. Finally, we propose an alternative model of determining the content of creation care, one marked by greater humility for science and a greater potential for success. As science is defined as the study of nature, science provides the truest, most objective, and authoritative view of the state of the environment. But the picture becomes cloudier when we ask whether science provides the authoritative description of environmental problems and the policies to address those problems. This idea may seem odd. If science provides an authoritative description of the state of the environment, and if we define environmental problems as harms to the environment, can we not also conclude science authoritatively defines environmental problems and the policies to solve those problems? The difficulty lies in the meaning of the word harm. As a normative term, harm implies knowledge of what the state of the environment should be, for harm either destroys an environmental state that should be or moves the environment away from the state that should be. Thus, the question is whether science alone is sufficient to define the state the environment should be in. If not, science is not sufficient to specify the goal of policy, that is, that ideal state, and so science alone cannot determine policy choice. In this portion, I argue just that, that science does not have the power by itself to specify this normative attribute of the environment, what the environment, quote, should be, unquote, and thus requires the input of something else, some sort of, quote, meaning, in order to specify that state. We can summarize our argument, or the argument I give symbolically, in this way. Science describes what is, but in order to determine what should be, that's the result of science plus some sort of sense of meaning. The first relationship expresses the idea that science provides a description of the state of nature, as I said, and the second relationship says that meaning, significance, or importance, when coupled with the description of the state, then will yield the description of what should be. Consider the statement, I am hungry. If in addition to the description of being hungry, we added the meaning of the hunger, for instance, maybe as a sign of injustice due to war-induced famine, or maybe proof that I'm dieting as part of a fitness plan, then we can infer a normative ought from the state description and its meaning. For the case of hunger coupled with the injustice meaning, we would conclude that you ought not be hungry. For the case of hunger coupled with the proof of dieting meaning, we would conclude that you ought to be hungry. Depending on the meaning of the what is, we can arrive at a very different conclusion of what should be. The meaning may come from any variety of sources. It could come from religious sources, ethical, etc. It is important to note, however, that these meanings do not come from the what is description itself. The meanings require an outside source. Thus, scientific descriptions of nature are not self-interpreting. Consider the case of a wetland that has been impacted by development. Science can describe much about the situation, the extent of the wetland in the past and present, the rate of wetland loss, the changes in the plant and animal species populating the wetland. But what does this description mean? We might answer that our scientific description shows development has damaged or degraded the wetland, but science has done no such thing. Science has shown development has decreased wetland extent, but not the undesirability of this decrease. The use of terms like damaged or degraded, because of their normative content, automatically confer a meaning on the decrease in wetland extent, but that meaning comes from the implicit value judgment carried with those words. For instance, that plenitude in animal life is a moral good, humans should not alter the landscape, etc. And it does not come from the scientific description itself. Thus, in order to infer an ought from a scientific description of nature, we need a non-scientific meaning partnering alongside the description. In contrast to our argument above, many believe science can determine, without external aid, what the state of the environment should be. For instance, some argue that a truly authoritative scientific description of the state of the environment will determine what the state should be. Symbolically, we can express it this way, science leading to what is, and what is leading to what should be. The first relationship, as before, expresses the idea that science provides a description of the state of nature. The second relationship expresses the idea that from this state description, we can directly infer a normative description of nature. The terms in that second relationship, however, are not logically entailed. In other words, what should be is not a logically necessary conclusion of what is, or vice versa. Returning to our hunger example, a person could say, "I am hungry," but that does not mean that they should be hungry. Perhaps they just finished a large meal. Conversely, a person could say, "I should be hungry," but that does not mean that they are actually hungry. Perhaps their stomach has adapted during a fast and they feel full. The mere fact something exists does not mean that it ought to exist, and the mere fact that something ought to exist does not mean that it does. If science by itself cannot define what the ideal state of the environment should be, and if the source of the meaning requires the source of the meaning that is required lies in ethics and values, we would expect that for controversial environmental issues, appeals to science would have little effect in dampening the controversy. Given the, quote, facts, unquote, as given by scientific studies, each party would interpret these observations in light of the meanings they found compelling based upon value commitments apart from science. Analysis of the role of science in environmental issues finds just as dynamic. From climate change to nuclear waste disposal to genetically modified foods, in all but the most trivial cases, disagreements that are fundamentally political and value-driven cannot be solved on the basis of science. Instead, as science policy scholar Daniel Sarewitz has noted, science tends to exacerbate environmental controversies because science, in the course of its normal functioning, generates such a large body of knowledge, it suffers from an, quote, excess of objectivity, unquote, and provides multiple lines of evidence that can be interpreted by the various parties in a controversy to fit their own agendas. The meaning of the scientific descriptions thus originates not in the science itself, but in each party's value judgments, and the scientific description is used as justification after the fact. This is not an accusation of dishonesty, but rather an argument that relying on science to settle environmental controversies is a categorical mistake. Value disagreements must be settled through value debates, not scientific debates. Only when significant political controversies are solved by other means will all parties consider the scientific solutions as obvious. Thus far, we have seen that science alone cannot define the ideal environmental state, and thus cannot define the goals of policy. Instead, science coupled with meaning can define the ideal environmental state and thus the goals of policy. Once that goal is determined, however, the choice of actual policies to achieve the policy goal is still not a value-free task, requiring only the application of technique. Science and ethics must still work jointly in choosing which policies to implement. In this section, we will consider the way science and ethics together achieve this. All problems can be thought of having the following form: A causing B, where A is some action or activity, B is some consequence with undesirable traits, and the arrow is the causal connection between A and B. For the case of global warming, A might be anthropogenic emissions of carbon dioxide, B might be increased global mean surface temperature, and the arrow, the greenhouse, or the enhanced greenhouse effect. Thus, the three possible solutions to any problem, besides not doing anything, which is, of course, an option too, but the three non-don't-do-anything possible solutions to any problem are to eliminate or remove A, to eliminate or remove the connection between A and B, symbolized by the little X, or to isolate B so none of the undesirable features can affect others, as I've symbolically shown. For the case of global warming, examples of solution one would be measures to decrease emissions of carbon dioxide, such as by decreasing fossil fuel use, capturing and sequestering carbon dioxide at the point of power generation, etc. An example of solution two is a proposal to place gigantic parasols in space to shade the Earth from part of the incoming solar radiation in order to balance out the increase in temperature due to the increase in carbon dioxide concentration. Lastly, examples of solution three include moving houses out of areas vulnerable to increased storm activity, such as floodplains, building seawalls to combat sea level rise, etc. If the policy goal defined by science and ethics is to prevent or remove undesirable traits of B, in principle, any of the above three solutions will suffice. The policy goal in and of itself does not determine which solution is preferable, as any of the three types of solutions can, in principle, achieve the policy goal. What then determines which of the three types of solutions, or a combination thereof, to choose? Here, too, we encounter the temptation to assume that science will provide the authoritative answer, that the cumulative effect of feasibility studies, impact statements, and basic research will produce the obvious solution. Indeed, because science is perceived as providing true authoritative and objective knowledge, policymakers and advocates of all views routinely appeal to the status to back their own agendas. The phrase, quote, best science possible, unquote, in fact, is used as a directive in a number of environmental statutes. The science policy research described earlier shows us, however, that the obvious solution only seems obvious after the value debates have been settled by other non-science-related means. Whether we acknowledge it or not, many times scientific descriptions actually play second fiddle to value assumptions when it comes to making specific policy choices. The debate over global warming, particularly in the evangelical church, provides an illustrative example and also provides warnings to us as we wrestle with the content of creation stewardship. Many, if not most, attempts to articulate the content of stewardship, whether they be Christian or secular, regarding global warming use a logic that's similar to the following. Science demonstrates the Earth's global mean surface temperature is increasing due mainly to human use of fossil fuels, and this increase is harmful. Thus, to prevent those possible harms, Christian stewardship entails action to decrease the use of fossil fuels. Suggestions for action, such as driving more fuel-efficient cars, enacting a carbon tax to discourage fossil fuel use, etc., are then given as examples of proper stewardship. Implicit in this schema is the idea that science, which has proven the reality and cause of global warming, naturally tells us what the solution is, namely mitigation by decreasing fossil fuel consumption. Thus, this definition of stewardship with respect to global warming has the implicit imprimatur of science and her attendant authority. As we saw earlier, however, the competence of science extends only to describing the state of the environment, for instance, the increase of global mean surface temperature due to the greenhouse gas effect, etc. The harm or meaning of the environmental state, and thus the goals of a global warming policy, come from sources outside of science, from ethics or religion. And since the goals for any given problem are, in general, of three different types, and the choice between those different types is not determined by the harm itself, something else besides the scientific findings or the policy goals justifies the mitigation policy choice. That justification is an unsaid and implicit value claim. That it is morally superior to remove the cause of an environmental problem like global warming than to allow it to continue with the problem in some other way. Some possible reasons for this justification include romantic idealism, where nature is best understood and appreciated in its pristine wildness, so it is undesirable for humans to alter nature, or ecocentrism, where nature can be considered as having a moral status independent of humans, perhaps with a good of its own, and thus humans should not interfere with nature, permitting it to attain its own good on its own terms. Minimalism, that it is a categorical moral imperative to minimize human involvement in the environment, whether that be positive or negative. For evangelicals, there's another reason people on both sides of the global warming issue will agree that if there is a problem, the primary solution is to eliminate the cause of the problem. When evangelicals consider moral issues, we use the sin model as our default point of reference. In the sin model, we categorize all human actions, individual and corporate, as sinful or not sinful. We reject activities that participate in or enable sin, provisionally accept those that do not, and analyze situations using the mindset of how do I avoid sin. This model has no small amount of scriptural backing, as God clearly loves righteousness and hates unrighteousness. Applied to personal acts defined as sinful in the Bible, this model yields some of the most important negative guidance found in Christian ethics. Stealing is sinful, so do not steal. Applied to the environment, this mindset implies certain ways of treating the environment are also sinful. Littering is sinful, so do not litter. Because we evangelicals habitually use the sin model in evaluating our behavior, this predilection to think in terms of avoiding doing wrong contributes to a bias for solutions that stop causes of environmental problems. This inclination, again, comes not from science, but from cultural values. And we have seen how science, for all of its power in describing the state of the environment, is unable by itself to determine either what the goals of environmental policy should be or the specific policies designed to implement those goals. How, as a result, science needs the partnership of ethics in order to arrive at the content of stewardship, but how we ignore the importance of such value assumptions. The result, our attempts at properly defining the content of creation care may suffer. A misplaced confidence in science feeds an ignorance of the importance of values in determining policy responses. That ignorance encourages the view that debate over science is crucial, but the debate over values is unimportant, which reinforces the misplaced confidence in science. The resulting, quote, scientization, unquote, of environmental problems feeds a dismissive attitude towards opposing viewpoints. After all, science proves your side is correct and prevents the values debate that is needed to reach agreement as to what values should determine policy goals and policy choice. This subterranean application of value judgments can distort the policymaking process. Consider, for instance, the sin model described in the last section, which, despite its prevalence, is seldom discussed. Because it is often a hidden assumption, there is little examination of its substantial weaknesses when applied to environmental issues. First, it is not clear that all activities that result in some sort of environmental harm are, in and of themselves, offenses to God. Second, while Scripture teaches that no amount of sin is acceptable, it is not clear that the same is true about actions that impact the environment. Is the discharge of any amount of pollution, say trace amounts of engine oil from a boat into the ocean, immoral? If not, how much constitutes a sin? Finally, the sin model, because it tends to narrow the scope of policy choices, risks discarding better alternatives without a hearing. For global warming, this means we focus on eliminating carbon dioxide emissions rather than adaptation to the possible impacts of climate change. These weaknesses are non-trivial and would suggest efforts by evangelicals to base creation care using this default assumption may lead to poorly conceived, even damaging policies. But because the sin model is applied unconsciously to environmental problems, these possible deficiencies are generally left unexamined. The efforts by evangelicals to contribute to the debates over climate change and other environmental problems are commendable, for even a cursory reading of Scripture will tell us how much God cares for the creation he has made and his desire for us to faithfully steward his handiwork. Unfortunately, we have inadvertently applied the clarity of the biblical imperative of creation care to the content of creation care. Through assuming science prescribes what action we must take to safeguard the environment, coupled with a lack of awareness of the value assumptions underlying our policy choices, we have defined stewardship using a flawed process. In this final section, we will consider an alternative model of determining the content of stewardship. Given our earlier arguments, this alternative model starts with giving science a humbler role in defining what creation stewardship entails, challenging us to avoid using science alone to decide the content of environmental stewardship. Such humility enables us to explicitly consider values to inform the content of creation care, and it also increases both the quantity of possible policies as well as the quality of the actual policies. In a study of four different ways scientists and scientific expertise can interact with policymaking, as a pure scientist, issue advocate, science arbiter, or honest broker of policy alternatives, science policy researcher Roger Pilkey Jr. finds that for problems characterized by little values consensus and high uncertainty, two conditions commonly found in the most difficult environmental problems, there is a need for scientists to act as honest brokers of policy alternatives who seek to expand the scope of policy choice. Such honest brokers, as opposed to specific policy advocates, creatively work to describe the full range of options available and the consequences of each action. In this way, honest brokers provide the raw material for finding a possible way out of seemingly intractable environmental controversies, more choices that may lead to a compromise acceptable to all parties. Pilkey notes that in the case of the debate over stratospheric ozone depletion in the 1970s and 80s, science played just such a humbler role in conjunction with policymaking. Policy consensus preceded scientific consensus, contrary to conventional wisdom, not the other way around, and policies implemented in the 1970s that separated essential and non-essential uses of chlorofluorocarbons, CFCs, helped spur advances in CFC alternatives that eventually obviated debates over a CFC ban. Expecting science to prescribe policy, particularly for environmental controversies, puts the cart before the horse and can prevent the healthy give and take between science and policy that can lead to policy alternatives that might otherwise remain hidden. Along with a humbler role for science, an alternative method of defining the content of creation care will understand many environmental problems as different from other problems, such as personal sin, in a fundamental way. There are many valid solutions instead of only a few solutions, and the best solutions require dialogue and compromise to achieve. May I suggest that what perhaps hinders the evangelical church from moving forward in unity in defining the content of creation care is that all of us believe our own visions of what constitutes creation care are authoritative, authoritatively justified on the basis of Scripture and authoritatively described on the basis of science. I've argued throughout the present work that the latter justification is untenable. Regarding the former, I suggest that while God commands environmental stewardship, the content of this command is defined differently from other commands. Unlike debates over doctrine, which are addressed entirely on the basis of exegesis, and unlike debates over social practices like abortion and the definition of marriage, where biblical mandate can be directly translated into action via ethics, in creation care, both values and science play a critical role in translating scriptural command into action. Given the high esteem of science in the public consciousness, however, the introduction of science also tempts us to assume science tells us what we must do. This is a mistake, and taken to the extreme, works against an openness to considering alternative ways of specifying the content of creation care. To move forward in creation care, we must do more than advocacy. We need even more than just mutual respect and tolerance. To achieve better stewardship solutions, we actually need the insights of those we disagree with. The science policy literature suggests such a route may be our best hope in defining the content of environmental stewardship for the most pressing and contentious problems, in all their messiness of uncertainty and competing values. Thus, through giving a role for science that avoids seeing science as policy prescriptive and understanding environmental problems as having many valid solutions, we improve the chances of defining stewardship content that is up to the task of addressing environmental issues in all their complexity and difficulty, and doing so in a way marked by greater thoughtfulness and humility rather than haste and vitriol. In such a way, we may also find ourselves better stewards of our relationships with one another as we jointly wrestle with how to work out our stewardship of the earth. Thanks very much for listening. Maybe one question, if there's any, and then we'll just move on. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. There are many ways, even within science, to express a particular state of affairs. You could say that there had been a totality of numbers, for example, expanding particular creatures.
Right.
You could express that in terms of proportionality.
Right.
And even the way that that is encoded is going to give a particular weight and significance to what is done.
Right.
So even within that community, how do you see someone without those kinds of abilities to encode and decipher? How do you see someone being able to construct a meaningful set of data?
In a sense, that's part of what I'm making an argument for, is that this actually links to what I was saying about Sarah Witz's argument about an excess of objectivity. In the very nature of science itself, both in its normal functioning, so not talking about any kind of pathologies, there are sort of a myriad of ways of trying to encode something and just even to view something. Actually, Sarah Witz uses the example of the ATOC experiment, and how the difference between the physical oceanographers in terms... this was an experiment where physical oceanographers proposed to try and get a better sense of whether or not global warming was happening using, I think it was a sonar array, right, across the Pacific Ocean or something, some active sonar work. In that particular project or project proposal, the physical oceanographers saw this with one particular lens, while those who were in the marine biology branch of science saw it with an entirely different lens and were part of the opposition for this particular project. Now, from one perspective, you could say both sciences, branches of science, are each seeking proper creation stewardship, and yet the way that they used their science to even look at one particular issue was entirely different. This is part of what Sarah Witz would call an excess of objectivity. So I think what you mentioned with regards to just how even different statistical measures can lead to sort of different emphases, I would lump that in part and parcel to that. And finding a way around that, I'm not sure there is a way around it, and I think that the normal functioning of science in controversial issues, that's okay, because part of the normal sort of functioning of democracy as we hash out these issues, having uncertainties doesn't necessarily impede or doesn't necessarily prevent some sort of policy progress, as the CFC ozone hole case demonstrates. So thanks for the question. So we're going to move on then to our second speaker. Jay Holman is assistant professor